This is AVXL episode 18, recorded June 23rd, 2016.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater and content, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I am Robert Herron.
Oh, my goodness. The quote of the episode, I think, is going to be from Mr. Robert Herron himself. HDR madness is afoot, which means just because we can't have technology without war, spec wars, Dolby Vision versus HDR10, including the addition of dynamic metadata. Robert saw a demo. We got a question about ambient light sensors on TVs. I have discovered that the $180 monoprice speakers, surround sound speakers, are actually $100 when they're on sale, and $140 now normally. The return of the HD Fury, a projector screen recommendation. I want to talk briefly about the death of the headphone jack, because it is coming in full force, and it is, in fact, already here. And then a little bit, finally,
I have a minor realization to add to that, too.
A few thoughts about CanJam.
CanJam!
And head-related transfer
functions. CanJam 2016.
So, the HDR madness is afoot, and
it
outside
is.
Of implying your love of Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Dun-da-da-dun! What was kind of cool, the folks over at hdtvtest.co.uk mm-hmm. put up an article, and they were basically going down the differences between Dolby Vision versus HDR10. And there are some spec differences in terms of like depth of bit color. But the big one everyone seems to focus on is this thing called dynamic metadata. And Dolby Vision is able to, per scene, in effect, change the overall characteristics of the picture. Specifically, light output, scene per scene, in order to best optimize it for a given movie. Whereas with HDR10, it's a fixed value. So it would be more like the average of the whole movie. What would be like the average picture level? So in the test setup they ran with at HDTV Test, they took one of the new E6 OLEDs from mm-hmm. LG and ran HDR10 into it. And then they found this same content through a source on Dolby Vision that they were supplying via a USB key. What they noticed was that the HDR10 video on the LG display coming from a Blu-ray player looked more washed out and blown out. The highlights were blown out. Overall picture quality, the average picture level, so to speak, was higher. It was brighter. But comparing that to the Dolby Vision encoded content, similar content, that looked correct. It seemed odd. And they tried a few different things. They tried playing with the TV settings. They ended up finding that the only thing that really kind of corrected the situation, at least as a temporary band-aid, was to take the Blu-ray player and go into its picture settings, knock its contrast level down by about 6 points, and then that brought the images closer, but still mm-hmm. not quite right. So this was just, I think, really just an interesting decoding issue that likely will be fixed in an upcoming update. But it just shows you right now that even if you have a TV like LG's OLED, there might be some software work to be done in terms of just making sure that playback of these new formats is as good as it can be. As a quick follow-up, though, they took that same HDR content coming from the Blu-ray player and put it into an LCD TV that was rated for high dynamic range, a very good one, and they didn't see the similar artifacting or the similar blown-out highlights that they were seeing in the OLED. So, it's likely a decoding issue, something in software that can be addressed, but it was interesting nonetheless. And at NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, their big convention, just wrapped up recently. And lo and behold, the good folks at Samsung were demonstrating HDR10 playback that included dynamic metadata, similar to what the folks at Dolby Vision are doing. So that was interesting. And I've got to say, subjectively, with the demo Samsung was showing, of course, the content encoded with dynamic scene per scene ability to alter the overall brightness and average picture level did look better than the content that wasn't encoded that way. So it sounds like Dolby Vision got something right that the HDR10 folks are quickly going to copy. The nice thing is, at least, this is all software on the HDR10 side. So a simple firmware update for any of these compatible devices should enable them to be compatible with this new HDR10 Plus dynamic metadata. And it's also the way they're doing it and adding it to the HDR10 standard, which has now gone on to the standards boards to be ratified and put into place. They're doing it in such a way that ensures compatibility with existing devices and things like that. They're not looking to break everything by adding this new feature for even better video. So fear not if you've already loaded up on all the cool ultra-high-def Blu-ray goodies and you're wondering if you will suddenly have to rebuy something because of this new metadata feature that might be coming soon. Don't worry about it. It should just be a software update, and I'm seeing, what was that? Firmware updates, according to Samsung, were coming later this year. So, You're good. I'm assuming that's probably for 2016 TVs, at least initially. I'm hoping they squeeze in maybe the premium 2015 models as well, but we'll see. It should be doable. It should be.
Interesting.
Then there's that ambient light sensor question you mentioned earlier. Was it Sirpa? Sirpa sent us a message on Patreon, and he mentions, or I quote, $200 tablets have sensors for adjusting to ambient light. Why don't televisions? And some do. And quite a few do, actually. And that's something to keep in mind. It's generally a feature I will turn off when I'm setting up a TV because I don't want it changing unexpectedly due to what's going on in the room. Mm-hmm. However, I personally actually use this feature because I got tired of, during the day, changing modes on my TV to make it brighter, and then at night, it being incredibly too bright for an evening time. And I'm then going back into the menus and turn down the brightness so it's not as blinding. Whereas I just then enabled basically an electronic eye, a room light sensor on the TV, a feature built in. And depending on what TV you have, you'll have a backlight control to set the minimum and or maximum levels of the light output from the screen. So that way, in a dark room, you can set it to where as dark as you want it to be without getting too dark.
Right.
Specifically, you're adjusting the backlight setting on an LCD. And then likewise, it either will automatically go to maximum when the room light's at a certain level of certain brightness, or some TVs actually provide a max cutoff where it's like, oh, don't go above, say, 90%, things like that. But they certainly do, and that's exactly what I currently have my setup for. I did a darkroom calibration with my LCD, but after that was finished, I set the room light sensor on, mm-hmm. and then I configured it in my particular case so that the minimum level, it didn't go too dark, and it looked good. And I find it works pretty effectively. It's one of those things where it can be hit or miss if you have weird lighting issues in the room, maybe a reflection or something's messing with the light sensor on the TV. But otherwise, it's an effective way to automatically optimize picture quality and right. to save electricity, too, when unneeded. Although LCDs nowadays are pretty energy efficient overall, even when run at 100%. So, but hey, save power where you can. But yeah. Ambient light sensors are fairly common, usually not on the bottom tier TVs. The TVs that are being stripped of all features to get the price down, you'll probably not find one there, but your mid-tier on up, generally speaking, that's something a lot of them have, although they don't really highlight it very much. It might be buried in some option setting somewhere, totally unrelated to the picture settings. It's something you might have to go dig for, but it's there. Check it out!
There you have it, people.
Check it out.
Oh, my goodness. The
you were talking about those monoprice speakers.
Yeah, no, then that was...
Wait, surround sound for $100?
Yeah, it was a Kenya deal. It showed up, I don't know, off a Lifehacker or Gizmodo. But Monoprice has done some fairly inexpensive. For example, they had the Energy Tate Classic. They're kind of clone of that. The Energy Tate Classic's kind of about as low as you can go for a decent set of surround sound speakers. They're $350.
I own a set of those.
I thought they had the Monoprice has an inexpensive. It's a set of speakers, satellite speakers. Basically, it's five speakers and a subwoofer. Normally sells for $140, and it's selling for like $100 right now.
Wow.
You know, premium select 5.1 channel home theater satellite speakers and subwoofer. That is about, you know, if
no excuses.
No excuses. Well, okay, you're still gonna need an
amp. Yeah, receiver.
A Navy receiver.
Yeah.
You know, and it's it's, you know, you need to be careful when you're buying a used AV receiver if you want to be able to run Blu-ray or some of the newer digital specs. But that is a long and drawn out subject for another show. But, you know, if you have a receiver and you want to take whatever, you know, 5.1 output you can get from your Blu-ray player or your Apple TV box or your Roku box or whatever you're using and run it through whatever 5.1 receiver you've got, or find at a garage sale or find cheap on Craigslist, $100 is about as cheap as you're going to get on speakers, and those will hold you pretty well.
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't go any lower than that for 5.1
right.
to recommend. Oh,
my
goodness.
We talked
I'm
about
shocked
16.
They're even that cheap. So.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you don't have to spend a lot of time on Alibaba to realize, or Amazon, to realize that there's a lot of tools. You know, there's a lot of things are made in China. A lot of things are made in China by the same factories. Laptops, televisions, tools, you know, infrared thermometers. You know, and I was sitting around one day with a $16 eBay thermometer. Not eBay,
infrared.
$16 off-brand infrared thermometer I found on Amazon.
I think I have one of those.
Versus my, you know, nationally known American Tool brand one that cost $80 and was getting the exact same results. And I'm pretty, you know, detail-oriented when it comes to tool construction, and they were basically the same product. So chances are this is something that somebody came up with somewhere that this is, you know, an inexpensive version of it. I
yep.
mean, but Monoprice built a lot of stuff. Like, you know, they sell... you know, decent over-ear, you know, headphones for $23.
Musical instruments.
Yeah. Well, they sell everything now.
That's the part that freaked me out.
yeah, they...
It's a good place to go for just about anything home theater related nowadays,
yeah.
and electronic instruments.
Well, we started buying HDMI cables there.
Yep.
You know, when you realize a, you know, $6 HDMI cable pretty much gives you the same performance as a $106 HDMI cable.
Yep.
And then you realize that, you know, you can find bad $6 HDMI cables, but
if you try.
But if you're sticking to like Amazon Basics or Monoprice, you're doing pretty well. Oh, the premium hi-fi DJ-style over-the-ear pro headphones, a.k.a. the Monoprice 8323, is now selling for $15.99. That is a, you know, if you have a child at home or if you're the kind of person that destroys headphones, you know, for $16, they'll have a decent audio experience and they're hard to kill.
I need a new PC gaming mouse. Maybe they make that too. I'll have to check.
We will check that
this time around.
Another time. Monoprice, by the way, is not a sponsor.
I did buy a pair of PC headphones, though, some USB ones, just to
Ooh.
Have. But you will laugh at how little I paid for these ridiculous things. But
well, let's
we'll get into that later.
Let's talk about headphone jacks for a second. The
yeah,
there were basically, you know, simultaneous unidentified sources. Basically, multiple news outlets basically said the iPhone 7, it's, you know, we've got confirmation the iPhone 7 is not going to have a headphone jack. And I've been thinking about this a bunch since I got hands-on, you know, with the new Lenovo phones and the new Motorola phones a few weeks ago in San Francisco. And Project Tango on the new Lenovo phone is pretty cool. And that's an amazing price for the phone you get for $499. But the Moto Z does not have a headphone jack, right? And that was striking to me because, because we've all been thinking for weeks or months, depending on how much you think about iPhones, or maybe you don't care at all. And that's what I'm kind of curious about. It's pretty much assumed at this point that the iPhone 7 it is considered a fact that the iPhone 7 will not have a headphone jack. And of course it's Lightning. And it was interesting,
I almost never use the headphone jack on my phone.
See, I use it constantly.
Yeah. I walk around. I see people with their earbuds in all the time, connected right to their phone. I see a lot of people talking mm-hmm. through the microphone and the controls on their earbuds connected to their phone.
Mm-hmm.
So that I understand. But me
right.
personally, the one thing I saw in reporting on this story was the relationship with DRM.
Yeah, well, Nilay Patel did a pretty good rant, and I don't think there's any better.
And that was something I hadn't even thought about. And it was like, oh, another way to get rid of, to plug the analog hole.
Yeah.
The analog escape port.
Well, as long as there's CDs, the analog escape port is not only available,
that's even a big deal anymore,
but it's legal.
As long as your
right.
content's DRM-free.
Well, it's an interesting thought, right? Because the idea of the analog loophole is like, well, they could have their Spotify account and they could digitally record the audio out of the headphone jack on their computer, or excuse me, sorry, their phone, which is thin but a possibility. But Nilay is pretty concerned about DRM on audio coming back. you know, like Nele, I'm not the biggest fan of wireless headphones. I think Bluetooth's fantastic, but Bluetooth, I don't like headphones that require additional batteries
it's
or
convenient.
Charging time. Well,
that's about it.
Yeah, but you know, the other thing is you know, I'm very curious to see if they will have created something where I can charge and listen at the same time. Because at this point, if you go to a single port on the phone and that port is used for charging and listening, unless they have another $30 dongle, and we presume they're going to ship some sort of dongle that will adapt
the
Type-C
octopus.
Port. Well, I mean, that's really interesting, right? Is it going to be, are they going to eliminate the earbuds in the box? Are they going to do earbuds with a lightning jack on the end of them? Are they going to ship a lightning jack to, which is essentially, right, because they're taking the DAC and the headphone amplifier out of the phone.
Are they envisioning the day where we all have hearing aids with Bluetooth built in?
Which is pretty cool. My neighbor rocks those, and he likes them a lot. You know, during Fireball, John Gruber did a pretty interesting response. Headphone jacks are the new floppy drive. He's basically, you know, the thing he points out, because
I never thought I'd see the component video cable go away.
Yeah,
gone. The composite video cable. Excuse me, the yellow cable.
It's
yellow
finally
jack.
Gone.
It's there if you look for it real hard. But yeah, it's.
Well,
it's at least they're not including those stupid cables in the box anymore. But
you know, so on during Fireball, John Gruber was like, "Oh, this is like complaining about Apple getting rid of the floppy drive," yeah. which I didn't particularly miss because I already hated floppy drives by the time they got rid of them.
Come to Android,
but
we'll have headphone jacks for a while.
But what Gruber does point out, he says, Patel misses the bigger problem. It's not enforcement of DRM on audio playback. It's enforcement of the M5 program for certifying hardware that uses the Lightning port. Right now, any headphone maker in the world can make any headphone they want for the standard jack, not so with the Lightning port. And it's been interesting because I've been using Audazy's the Sign, which is their new closed headphone, and they have an optional Lightning cable. They call the Cypher Lightning cable.
Huh.
And it's been interesting. It's, you know, the cable sounds good, but you're basically talking about a $60 cable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, though, you're already in the Apple ecosystem.
Yeah, but
you're used to these kind of fees.
True, right? Because
I'm not saying Android phones are cheap either, but
you can spend you can get like the Apple, the Lightning to USB camera adapter, which is what basically the Lightning to USB adapter, which is what people use to. That's what people use to connect external DACs to the iPhone,
totally.
which are going to, you know, I'm really curious to see what the battery life ends up being on with these, but.
Still waiting on my 48-hour battery phone. No.
Good luck with that. Keep waiting.
Yeah.
Nuclear
powered.
You know, and I'll admit, I haven't destroyed, I haven't destroyed a headphone jack in a really long time, but I'm curious to see how this is affected. I'm frustrated because now we're going to end up with another I can't use my Lightning headphones on my wife's Android device. There's some interesting questions about how this is going to impact the MacBooks. But there was a nice, summary, that Gruber kind of went back and posted, from a tweet from Never Morgan, quote, "Removing the iPhone headphone jack is a fine long-term goal. Complaining about the short-term annoyance is also fine. These are compatible."
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know,
it's not like Apple changes everything every year or anything like that. They take their time about making these adjustments. And I mean, look, they're still using LCD screens on their phones.
Yeah,
and
probably because they can't. The theory at this point is that they can't actually get the volume up they need to do LED.
I wouldn't doubt it.
And that's
a great problem to have.
Yeah, it is a pretty funny problem. Well, you know, it's not a whole lot going
actually,
on.
Actually, what was
the iPhone 7 otherwise?
S7 took over all sales.
Yeah,
biggest selling phone this year. So,
if not on this year's phone, if you're buying a phone this year, it may not be this year, but certainly in the next year or two, it's going to be interesting to see if they manage to kill off the headphone jack or if that turns out to be a temporary. An unfortunate side. Well, remember, right? Because Samsung, they got rid of the micro SD slot, and then the next year it was back.
It's back. So, I want them to bring back the infrared port now.
Yeah.
I think I'm the only one. No, there's a few people I talked to. They're like, what? The S7 doesn't have the infrared port? And I'm like, no.
I can't use it as a remote. Well, you could also do an adapter, but then you have to buy more hardware. on one hand, I see this as a great opportunity to have external DACs and headphone amps with great performance, although the one that is in the iPhone 6 is pretty solid as is. It'll be interesting to see how much that ends up costing, how much those ends up costing, because the M5 certification is not something a lot of vendors like going through.
I'm more concerned with things like, is the phone waterproof? How good is that camera?
Yeah.
Basics.
Basic usability. I'm really curious to see what the camera ends up
when will my mobile device have a smoke alarm and CO2 alarm built into it? How hard could that be? Considering, especially for people traveling. Ugh.
Ladies and gentlemen, about doing a podcast with Robert is realizing that you may not be nearly as paranoid as you
thought. What a freaking tricorder.
It's coming.
It should be there.
Well.
I don't need another heart rate monitor. I need something.
Physiology is complicated.
Tell me if my local environment is hazardous to my existence.
Oh,
run!
My goodness.
Anyway.
Projector screens or can jam?
Quick projector screen. What was that about?
Tom Slowowski tweets, I just ordered a 3,000 lumen projector and want to get an inexpensive outdoor screen. Any recommendations? Then number one, use a wall. If your house is white, use a wall. If you don't, if you want to spend the least amount of money, get out your roll of Gorilla tape and a sheet.
If this is going to be outside with light of any kind to deal with, like you're shooting it maybe like dusk or right when the sun goes down and there's still some light out, that kind of thing, then you probably don't want to go for the biggest screen possible. I don't know what the overall setup's aiming to be here. Are you looking to do a 15-foot screen and you're waiting till it gets dark? If that's the case, you're shooting it like the side of a house or something. And any flat colored surface, honestly, it could even be shingled siding or something. It's still going to look pretty good. Any big unremarkable surface is going to be fine. However, I do use a portable screen that I've had for years, and I absolutely love it. And I want to say it was made by Epson, and they call it the Duet. Let me check it out real quick. It's an 80-inch.
It's funny because you might not realize it.
80-inch portable screen for about $130, say, and it collapses down into a nice portable hard case package that's extremely quick to set up. I find this is the perfect screen to play a Wii on or console gaming.
Right.
80-inch screen outside. It is awesome. The base is excellent. It's aluminum tube tripod base. Super sturdy. Like I said, I've taped a sensor to the top of the screen and had the backyard just one big gaming session that way or for movie night.
Right.
Otherwise, if you're looking at bigger screens, they have everything from, you know, an inflatable option.
And it's funny because the inflatable options, what I was starting to say before is this is becoming a pretty common thing for people to do to the point where
easy.
Like, yeah, well, I mean, the air blown outdoor inflatable 12-foot diagonal movie screen for a backyard theater on Walmart.com, which sells for a whopping $140, has 152 reviews and is advertising like 4.5 stars. The same product for 169, basically the same. Yeah, the same product, actually the exact same product from Target is $170 and it has 64 reviews at 4.5 stars.
Most of those screens are going to be standard white. Maybe a one gain or higher, so they reflect more light to be look a little brighter. You're not as concerned about absolute picture quality. You've got a fairly bright projector. Chances are, if it's 3,000 lumens, that's 3,000 lumens at probably its worst looking picture quality.
Right.
So you might, if you try to compensate for that a little bit and knock it down to its maybe standard mode, where you're still getting good light output, to get better picture quality, then you'll lose a little bit of the light output there. Yeah. But otherwise, put it in the right spot. Absolutely recommend it. My 80-inch screen might be too small for what you're thinking of, but that's a good balance, I think, between dealing with outdoor light or other light sources and being big enough for a lot of people to enjoy.
Yeah.
And still portable enough to where you can put it away and it's not a big deal. Literally, it can sit in a closet like a 8-inch square this thing can sit in, and it's super convenient for that Epson Duet. But
I mean, the big thing is how long does it take you to set up? I mean, Camp Chef, you know, the people who make, you know, camp stoves, they sell a, you know, 144-inch indoor-outdoor movie screen.
Buy a you know, a king-size white sheet at the dollar store or whatever and start with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, get that nice and taut.
Yeah. The inflatable ones don't require a wall.
Take a piece of PVC tube or whatever for across the top. Make your own first if you can. Something you can just collapse and put away.
The inflatable ones are a little puffy. The Camp Chef is one of the ones where they basically, you know, it's a steel frame you put together and you strap the screen to it.
Oh, that Duet screen, by the way, it has two widths locks. So it'll go to 16:9 when you fully extend it, or it'll do 4:3.
Oh,
so
that's pretty cool.
If you're dealing with whatever. But usually you just put it in 16:9. And
yeah.
I love that thing. I've had it forever.
There's so many options. Start with a sheet. Work your way up from there.
Indoors, I even would point it at closed doors. Like a set of double doors that happen to be painted white. And you know, it's not the greatest surface in the world, but for what I was
doing. Once the movie starts going, nobody notices.
Nobody cared. This was for like regular TV viewing too. So it was like not critical.
Yeah. Stretch Screen USA on Amazon.com.
Then the,
they do 120-inch spandex projector screen, and they basically, you know, send it with hook eyes and a couple of bungee cords.
Totally.
You just get some standard screen material and stretch that out.
Totally.
You know, on some PVC pipe or some inexpensive, pipe you can find locally.
Let me think. For reflectivity, to get the most light out of it, it should be a little more reflective. It shouldn't be as neutral, but
right.
But if you start with the side of a wall somewhere first.
Yeah.
Do a little experiment to see if that's acceptable, if the location's okay. But then if it requires a screen and you want to be able to put that somewhere.
Yeah, if your house is purple, that can be problematic.
That can't be. That might not work.
Yeah.
Oh. But I love my Epson Duet. I got to say, that thing has held up really well over the years. And sitting in my storage unit, but it's awaiting another projector to show up so I can take advantage of it for a... Especially now that baseball season's here, projector companies, feel free to send me. Actually, you know what? Sony's got that new 1080p 45 series projector that just came out, HDR compatible and 3D and blah, 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 for the same price point they had their 40 series at. So,
white or gray?
I would do white if you're doing outdoors.
Okay.
It's
because now
you don't need contrast enhancing. You need all the light flinging back as possible.
I'm on Carl's Place now, which is CarlOFET.com, which is a DIY projector screen material place.
As soon as the sun sets, it's going to start looking better and better. Mm-hmm. And even before it gets completely dark out, it'll hit a tipping point where suddenly the picture just pops. And you're golden. And then it's going to be that 3,000 lumens is going to be way too much.
People will be putting on their sunglasses.
People will be like, I'm just going to leave the sunglasses on.
Oh, you know what? Carl's Place now has a whole section of backyard DIY standing screens.
I've heard of Carl's Place before. So.
They're pretty cool. They basically sell projector fabric.
Perfect.
So if you have the ability to build a projector or permanently mount a projector.
If not the Epson Duet, if 80 inches ain't doing it, go talk to Carl.
Go talk to Carl.
Carl's it.
Oh, my goodness.
Good stuff. I calibrated my first E6 OLED this week.
How'd that go?
That was pretty awesome, I got to say. Beautiful. And I'm getting some new hardware this week, tomorrow, that will... We've mentioned this product before. It was the HD Fury Integra. It's this little box, basically, that allows you to effectively control all things HDMI in terms of copy protection.
Right.
Video format.
Essentially, it's
color standards.
It's HDMI and HDCP. And if you have, for example, let's say you bought a $40,000 projector 8 years ago.
There's one use for it.
An example use. This would be, in theory, a legal use.
You don't have a display that's compatible with a copy protection format, say, from a new Blu-ray player.
The HD
this
Fury
could sit
should
in the
get
middle
around that.
And mitigate that.
I bring that up because we had issues. Some of the earlier HD Furies did not work at all, much less how we expected them to.
I remember those days. This particular device, though, the Integra, I think I'm saying that right. God, I should actually look, as long as I keep repeating this. I'm going to use it specifically for injecting HDR10 metadata into a video stream.
Ooh.
So I can trigger TVs to go into their HDR mode for calibration and testing and things like that. The new Calman version, my favorite calibration software, they just released a new version yesterday called Calman 2016, and they're actually integrating support for this, and I was actually pretty pleased to see that. It's some of the current HDR signal generators that are out there right now are thousands of dollars. I mean, they're super expensive. You're not going to be guaranteed compatibility with a single external generator for HDR10 and Dolby Vision.
Right.
You're usually using two separate devices for that, if even possible currently. So I'm really looking forward to seeing if this can also provide any of the Dolby Vision triggering mechanisms as well for other displays. But I have other means of doing that. This was specifically for me to be able to get the TV to be an HDR display So then I can look at all those specific controls and to be able to deal with it. So I'm looking forward to it. I get that tomorrow. I'll do some testing over the weekend with the HDR sets I have on hand. And then I'm going to apply it to yet another E6 OLED. I have a couple clients with E6 OLEDs, a production house company and a private client who both have a... Everyone I know, the last three TVs I've looked at were all E6 OLEDs from LG. So thin glass back design, calibrated beautifully. The one I looked at looked really good. LG's got some unique calibration features in their 20-point grayscale setup. Specifically, you can measure 100% white, get the luminance output, or what are the nits coming off of that. You actually plug that number back into the TV, and it helps with the rest of the calibration in a really unique way. And it seems to work fantastically. And I really like it. So other than that weirdness with HDR10 playback on from Blu-ray players we were talking about earlier, this should be a cool piece of hardware, and it will save me thousands of dollars if it works out. So, and it should be a more flexible piece of gear that works with other gear I already have. So super looking forward to that. Lots of good stuff.
Oh, my goodness. So I had some requests to talk a little bit about CanJam. I should also point out the San Francisco HeadFi meetup is on July 16th, not the 11th.
Oh, cool. And that is the West Coast All Things Headphone. Is it free to attend, or do you just pay at the door?
That's a fine question. I believe it is free. Let me go to the...
if you're in the Bay Area,
I'm on the web page. If you've never been, if you're curious about headphones, if you want to learn more about headphones, head-fi.org, head-fi.org is an amazing website. I know the crew that runs it. They're good
people. Meet your people.
Registration is $15 online, $20 at the door. It's at
cool.
the Wikia headquarters, 363rd Street, San Francisco, California. It runs from 10 until 6 p.m., and that is on July 16th, 2016. I'm pretty sure you're going to have to pay your own freight on that one.
Right? Oh,
well.
They got my $15.
What's crazy about it is it's an opportunity, one, to hang out with people who like audio, and two, for CanJam was pretty incredible. Yeah, exhibitors... Let's see, Amps and Sound, Astell and Curran, Cavalli Audio, Dana Cable, Echo Box Audio, Focal, Head Amp, the new Focal headphones I want to hear, Head Amp Audio, Hi-Fi Man, JH Audio, Mies, Mr. Speakers, Noble Audio, Questyle, Sennheiser, Shit, Taction, Technology,
oh, cool.
TrueFi, Wells Audio, Woo Audio. I actually got to log into my, I'm a lurker on HeadFi. I don't contribute a lot.
You lurker.
I'm a lurker. So I got.
Are you going to be lurking around CanJam 2016 here in the Bay Area?
Well, CanJam 2016 was actually down in Orange County. This is basically a HeadFi meetup. So
HeadFi
it's like a smaller.
Meetup. All right, let me get my events.
A smaller gathering. But the thing about, I got to listen to a bunch of stuff I wanted to hear from Oppo and Shit. And
what's Oppo doing?
Oppo does headphones. Some very, very nice headphones.
Very good.
Talk about them more another time.
Cool.
And kind of thing I came out with from this show is there's some really expensive stuff that's really nice. And there's some cheap stuff that sounds really nice. But head-related transfer functions is what really had me thinking. The biggest whoa moment for me was OSIC 3D, which was a Kickstarter project. And I actually ended up backing it. And OSIC...
I think you mentioned these guys a few shows ago.
Yeah. So they're basically doing 3D audio. And they're doing head tracking, which isn't that unusual. And they have multiple drivers inside the can, which is not the newest thing ever. But what they are doing is essentially calibrating. When you put the headphones on, it calibrates them to your anatomy, i.e. the width between your ears. And that allows them to be more precise with their use of the individual drivers to create audio that seems realistic, right? Because when we listen to something... whether it's the dogs in the warehouse next door to us at the place where they save dogs, or if you're out in nature, or if something explodes in the distance, or if we are talking, you don't just that sound comes from, say, Robert speaks, and the words from Robert also bounce against the walls, and then they bounce to my ears, and in the process of my head moving, I have this incredibly... Humans have this amazing ability to sort of pinpoint audio or where the audio is coming from. And a lot of what goes on with stereo speakers is creating a sound image. And you can be like, oh my goodness, you know, that Pink Floyd album makes, you know, the stuff from the left channel sounds like it's coming from 8 feet to the left of that speaker, right? But, you know, when we have well-recorded audio that is presented on a good set of speakers and good amplification and has been well-decoded or from the digital to the analog in the converter or is coming from an album, the idea is that, you know, if it's done well, you have this sort of image and be like, wow, there's the singer and the guitar players over there and the drums and the this and it's
so those headphones then
so these
actually
headphones
recalculate the transfer function that it's dealing with based upon the distance between your ears.
Basically, that's what they're saying.
Cool.
Yeah, and I didn't get to hear the full VR demo. That was at another event.
That
weekend.
Just saw a publication. I want to say it was like a PC style publication where they just spent $50,000 on a head transfer function head system.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other
testing headphones.
If you want to learn about testing
more
headphones,
objective way.
Well, yeah, and that's a big deal. If you are curious, if you want to learn,
but that's
everything,
cool that you actually have a pair of headphones though that can dynamically recalculate a function that goes into how they sound based upon the fit of the user.
Yeah.
That's pretty slick.
So, you know, to get the full sort of 3D experience, you're going to be plugged into a USB jack. Before I go any farther, if you want to learn about headphone testing, innerfidelity.com.
Innerfidelity.
Innerfidelity.
I like that name.
Started by the guy who founded Headroom, who's essentially the reason... he's basically the reason headphone amps are a thing.
Cool.
Tile, and I'm probably saying his name wrong, and I apologize because he's had an incredible influence on me as a listener. But he's been going through, he's actually working with the Harmony people and getting his measured, and he does some of the most sophisticated measurements out there. And he's been going in the last few months to this big sort of conversation about what headphone measurements mean and what they can do and what they can do. And it is great stuff. That's innerfidelity.com. So I was so impressed by the Osix, and it turns out I own a number of products built by one of the founders of Osix who ran Logitech's audio division for a decade. So I feel comfortable that they'll be able to deliver them. So I've invested my own money in that Kickstarter to get a listen to them. I'm curious to see if they are as amazing with stereo audio coming off my computer as they are with the demo. So that was a big one for me. There were some great sub-$100 DACs. I got to hear Emotiva's Stealth, which is a $500 DAC, but they're Big Ego and Little Ego. Little Ego's on sale right now for $100. The Shit Fulla is amazing for $100. AudioQuest Dragonfly, I've owned one of their models for years. Also a fantastic piece of hardware. Like if you have a decent pair of headphones and you want to step up sort of the decoding of the audio and the amplification, either of those three products are fantastic.
You kept saying how the Nighthawks grew on you over time.
And yeah.
That's something that always kind of stuck with me. It's like, well, the longer you had them, the more you just appreciated them. And it was like,
Nighthawks,
that's
so
a nice way for any product to go, where it's just over time, things just got better and better.
Well, they told me when they sent me a pair to review, they say, look, you got to listen to them for like 45 hours, 100 hours. You know, and there's a lot of stuff going on.
Unlearn what you have learned.
Yeah. Well, it's
something.
It's,
like that.
So there's, you know.
No, I get you.
The big thing about them, right, is, you know, one, they're one of the most comfortable headphones I've ever worn, and they've kind of become my go-to for a lot of listening. You know, Skylar, the designer, had a blank sheet and started working from the ground up, and, you know, because he's working for AudioQuest, there was a lot of flack being handled because they do pretty amazing marketing, right? And people are like, oh, biocellulose drivers. You mean cardboard? Well, actually, biocellulose drivers are bacteria poop that's been compressed into this incredibly rigid substance. If it's good enough for, Bowers and Wilkins and Sony on their high-end products, I think it's AudioQuest going with that is a pretty good concept. He worked really, really hard to eliminate distortion from
anywhere you can
the
say
motor
bacteria
and the speaker
poop in your product.
Yeah, I've just wanted to say that because I'm a freak, but you know, but they basically, you know, he's
high-tech,
he made some
poop.
Yes, it's very high tech. It's high tech bacteria poop, but you know, building the drivers like speakers, so you know, they're not
totally
Mylar. They have, you know, sort of a traditional rubber surround. So there's no, there's no issues with the driver or the speakery looking part distorting as it's driven. The motor design is pretty interesting, but the really big decision early on when they decided, when Scholar decided not to apply a free field or diffuse field correction curves. And so the idea is they started measuring people probably back in the 70s, I want to say. They would basically take a room. They'd take a single point source of audio, and they would measure it with a microphone, a calibrated microphone, and then they would take one of those measuring heads, which basically has, it looks like a head and shoulders with two ears, and inside of each of the ear canals in the head is a microphone. And that's what you use to do, you know, to basically simulate head measurements or to measure headphones. And what they noticed is, you know, you could generate this sort of pink noise or this flat curve or this flat audio signal, and there would be a big old spike. You know, from like, you know, somewhere between 1,000, 1,500 hertz, way up through 5,000 hertz. And,
this is related to just the design of it where,
well, this is happens when you generate a tone or like, let's say you, I want to say they generate pink noise.
Kind, wasn't it?
Well, what happens, right, is we talked about your voice bounces against everything around us, right? But the last thing it bounces against is our head and our shoulders and our ears. Mine are much bigger than yours, the ear part that's outside of my head. And then, of course, your ear canal before it finally gets to the actual eardrum where the sound kind of gets heard. The air pressure gets turned into the stuff that your skull hears. And whether you're looking at free field, which is a single like speaker or point source of audio, or diffuse field where they surround, they run sound for 360 degrees, is, you know, a flat signal has a huge bump between like, you know, basically starting around 1,000-1,200 hertz all the way up through you know 3,000 like 5,000-6,000 hertz. And
is that due to like our perception of voices and things like that, or
it's because of the way audio,
or is it just the interaction with our physical
body?
Okay,
right?
Cool.
So a lot of the ideas for a lot of headphone manufacturers are like, oh well, if we clamp headphones over the ears, you're eliminating all of this stuff that happens, because when you this is not
better,
most
isolate the speaker from the surroundings,
right? So what we're going to do is to make up for this difference between what we hear with a microphone and what you hear, because what you hear is a whole bunch more in this, you know, 1,000 hertz to 5,000 hertz range. So we're going to emphasize that range in our headphone designs to make up for the fact that you don't have
all right, Audio Quest, you might have me here.
Well,
any
but this is right. Well, here's the thing though: almost all headphones are designed to emphasize, not all, but many headphones emphasize that sort of 1,000, 2,000 to 5,000 or 6,000 hertz range, which is where a lot of the music actually occurs. So that they
the voices too.
They tend to be, and in the extreme versions, they tend to be fatiguing because there's a lot of high end. They tend to emphasize the high end. And what you start to realize is the Skylar, the designer's point is like, look, the way we hear stuff through headphones is not necessarily the way it sounds when you hear it live, because
totally,
there's this big push at the high end. So I'm not going to put this artificial, I'm not going to calibrate my headphones to have this artificial push. So one of the things that happens is you start wearing these headphones, you start to notice how sparkly and bright a lot of other headphones are at the high end. But
totally.
They're incredibly comfortable. They're not cheap. They're like $600. But when I was sitting there, like at the Cavalli audio table, listening to like a $6,000 tube-based headphone amplifier, which is a nice piece of machinery.
Tubes.
I don't normally like, I'm a big tube fan, but these
I
are
like the
really
tubes.
Nice headphone amplifiers. But, you know, when you're listening, you know, I kept finding myself putting down like the Hi-Fi Man HE1000, which is an amazing headphone. It's like a $3,000 headphone. And coming back to the Nighthawks, because
oh,
I
nice.
Really liked how neutral their sound was by comparison. So you started me on that. I apologize.
No, it's all good.
Astell & Kearns AK Junior. It was funny. Like, I got to listen to the Astell & Kearns AK380, the copper version of which weighs like 94 pounds and costs $4,000. It's a portable player.
Oh, okay.
But it's heavy.
Like, oh, that's right. That's the one you have, your beautiful little brick.
Well, I have the AK100, which
is
the very, very first one.
Yeah.
iRiver started Astell & Curve, and that's still an amazing
device.
Designs. They're doing some good stuff. So for most people who don't have $2,500 or much less $4,000 for an all copper portable player, the AK Junior is around $450. That's a pretty fantastic deal. And Fio, who was not at Can Jam, but they do like their entry level stuff for $100 to $300, is a pretty fantastic deal.
Cool.
Yeah, so many other things I could talk about, but I'm going to stop before I put everybody to sleep with my headphone lust. And
I finally got around to those one more triple driver earbuds, and
They're really good.
I finally got a set. I did not realize how critical the placement of the earbud within the ear canal affects the audio on those, at least for me personally. I had to use the smallest. Thankfully, they came with this assortment of probably 10, 15 different tips that you could put on the earbuds.
Mm-hmm.
And then that allowed me then to get the smallest tip I could to get it further into my ear. Because once I hit a sweet spot at a certain point, if I didn't get it in far enough, I just wasn't getting good bass, good resonance. But when it did, I was quite pleased with what I was hearing. And I actually currently have this connected to my computer while I replace headphones that just went south on me on those. But I'm actually enjoying the earbud experience. The isolation, too. I kind of always forget the good and the bad of sitting at a computer where you can't hear anything around you. So there is that. And I'm also finally getting around to the Riva Audio S speaker, their portable Bluetooth speaker. I've been using that almost exclusively with my TV and for just streaming podcasts and stuff like that. And what a fantastic portable speaker. I mean, I love the Turbo X. That thing is like their boombox of a portable Bluetooth speaker. But the compact size and the good audio quality that I'm getting out of the Riva S, no complaints there either. I'm living the high life. But yeah, I think those one more earbuds are like $100.
Yeah, they're an amazing.
And they came
the
with
triple
like a
driver
kit of
14 different sizes.
A bunch of ear tips of different sizes, different materials. I didn't like the tips actually that put the little rubber like crosshatch pattern over the driver. They had ones that were more like squishy foam that left the center open, so the driver was completely uncovered. And I felt the sound was a little bit better on those, but that was just me personal subjective. More about just trying all the different tips and seeing how it dramatically changed the audio quality and the perception.
They're a fantastic...
Doesn't matter what earbuds I think you're using, most of them come with multiple tips. Try them all.
Yeah.
Because usually I'm like, oh, I need the biggest tips you have to stuff into my giant ears. This wasn't the case. I actually wanted to get that driver further in my ear canal just for how much better it sounded once it was in there.
It's amazing how much better earbuds sound when you actually have a decent seal between the earbud and your ear canal.
Isolation's critical. I mean, my last pair of earbuds were Shure. I don't think they were E3Cs. They're pretty old. But they had these great disposable foam tips that were like earplug material that you literally had to crush down and then slip in like an earplug. And that gave superb isolation. You could really turn the volume down and still experience it all. You'd never had to turn it up, especially if you're in noisy environments. Those were my commuting earbuds for sure on the train. Our noisy light rail system here in the Bay Area. Laugh of the nation.
The one mores aren't the quietest
ones. It did save my hearing and my sanity.
Oh my goodness. They're anyway. They don't offer the best seal I've heard off of earbuds, but
yes,
the sound is fantastic. Number one, M-O-R-E. That's one more. Triple driver in-ear headphones are available on Amazon if you're looking for the website, because their headphones are pretty interesting.
For that
too.
Price, I was super pleased. And
it's a fantastic deal.
And they are mobile phone compatible, so they've got the built-in microphone and the controls right on the right earbud wire.
No microphone, though.
Oh, no mic? Well,
I don't think
bad.
There's a
Never
mic
mind.
On them.
I actually haven't tried it. I just noticed there were some controls on there, and I assumed there was a microphone built into that little whoopee.
I will double
Might
check.
Might not be, though.
I thought there wasn't. In any case, fantastic. Really nice low end on those two.
Yeah.
One last thought before Super we go, because I gotta call it.
You got stuff to do.
One last CanJam exhibitor was Comply Foam, ComplyFoam.com. They sell tips for earbuds.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. They break them by comfort, sport, isolation, IEM wraps. They're doing tips for Jaybirds, Sennheisers.
I just spent $200 on ear protection. Four cases of disposable ear plugs.
Well, that's a whole other conversation we can have about earplugs that actually allow you to still hear music.
But that's something else. This is just safety-oriented earplugs with the highest rated noise reduction I could find and comfort.
27 dB?
32 on the ones you shove way in your ear and 30 on the stick ones that the kids like a little more.
Stick ones.
Stick ones. Goodness. I don't like those stick ones scare me. I just picture somebody slap me in the side of the head and then it just disappears. Somebody's got a pair of needle nose pliers laying me on a table.
I've had monitor chips stuck in my head. It's not fun to reach into your ear.
I had a mutual friend of ours, Annalisa. Bless her soul, one day I had the rubber tip come off in my head, and and it was so far in there I couldn't even touch it. And I gave her my Leatherman. In the office. I'm like laying on a table in the office.
Help me.
Good old Annalisa. Bless you. I miss you so much, but she totally like saved me.
That's funny.
Operating on the side of me with a Leatherman reaching into my ear.
Lesson of the day, people. Don't stuff your in-ear monitors.
Make sure those tips are on
ear.
Properly so they don't come off in your head.
Sometimes they just do. Oh my goodness.
Ladies and gentlemen. Be there for your friends.
Yes.
Yes. That
be
too.
There for your friends. Help your friends carry their new monitor into the house. Help them pull those cables through the wall and help them pull those earbuds out of their
lift with your knees.
Lift with your knees. Go to the dentist twice a year. Cardio, people.
Is it Friday?
It's
it
Friday.
Better be.
No, it's Thursday. With that, avxl.com is the website.
Love your support.
We love your support.
And your questions.
If you'd like to support us, and we would appreciate that, the place to go is patreon.com/avxl. Our first hangout.
We got to get that done.
Yeah, we're gonna try to do one this weekend, and we're going to try to do one next week just to get this thing rolling because we owe you a couple hangouts. And
we're on a roll, though. We got episode posted. The other one is with our Patreon members right now, and that will go live probably later today.
Later today.
And then this episode, I'm going to hack and slap and get it up. It'll be up.
Patreons today,
if
Saturday.
Stay away from Doom. Stay away from my front end suspension on my car.
Yes.
Till the weekend. Then I'll get to that. And then stop buying tools. Although I've got that HDR 10 metadata injector coming. I'm screwed, man.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Robert Herod.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.